I think the term food as medicine could be used in at least three ways. The first way would be the most fundamental way that Hippocrates used it, which is that food is fundamental to health. And the way that, traditional Chinese medicine and lifestyle medicine practitioners today or RDNs today all know that food is foundational to health. The way that Native American, tribes or indigenous people in Alaska, or people around the world have known for centuries. That is true. And that is one kind of way to talk about food as medicine. I've also heard people who are thinking of that construct just say food is health or food is life, right? That's kind of the foundational construct.
Team, welcome back. Happy 2024. Happy New Year. Hopefully, well, I personally don't stay up until midnight on New Year's. I'm not sure where you don't either. Yeah,
No,
I
definitely
think
not.
one, I don't think anybody with kids does, but certainly I think that anybody who's sort of self-respecting and appreciates sleep.
I'm all about sparkling apple cider and a responsible bedtime.
Sparkling apple. Oh, versus
In place of
champagne.
champagne, yeah.
What? Eggnog for New Year's. Here's a quick tip for folks. Now that it's the new year, we're looking to save some space in our life, maybe clean up some junk. I picked this up off of Instagram the other day. I think I have like 10,000 something photos on my phone, but here's a fun trick for you iPhone users out there, maybe Android people too. I don't know. But if you go to your photo file, your photo app, and you select all your photos and you search the date, so today's date, it'll bring up the photos that all the photos you have taken in your phone on today's date over all the years. And number one, it's cool to look back, but number two, you can delete a lot of the dumb stuff that you don't need anymore. And if you do that over time, not every day, but every couple of days, eventually you'll have trimmed your photo library. So Alex, I don't know what you think about that. That's my today's useful hint.
As the Android representative on this podcast, I will say that first off, Google already kind of does that for me. It like
Oh my
notifies me if there's
God.
any noteworthy pictures from previous years and makes a little memory collage of them. And then I will state that
Well,
my
Apple does that
preferred
too.
method.
Apple does that too. Ours
Sure,
even
I
have
believe you.
music.
Yeah, mine has music too. Don't worry about it. But I will also add that my preferred strategy for managing space on my phone is that when your phone gets full, I get a new phone.
I don't think you've ever sounded like a bigger douche.
My phone has like two or three cracks in the screen and is like at least 4 or 5 years old, and it's still not full, still not full, and that's including making all this nonsense content for Mobs and Mos.
When my car runs out of gas, I don't fill up the tank. I just buy a new car. Love it. Anyway, back to business. We have a long bio this week because the guest we have on today is, I think, accomplished is a safe bet. Alex, who
I
are we
would say
talking
he's
to?
definitely accomplished. He for sure has his own Wikipedia page. I was interested because I thought he might have been one of our first to have a Wikipedia page. No, he is our seventh guest who has their own Wikipedia page. I checked that right before we hopped on to record this
Who was
intro.
our first Wikipedia guest?
I don't remember who the first was. I'd have to go back and check. I just went through the podcast tab on our website and checked each time I hit a name that was relatively famous, whether they had a Wikipedia or not.
Fair enough.
More recently, you can tell that we're an ascendant podcast. But anyway, who's our guest? Our guest is Dr. Dariush Mozafarian. He's a cardiologist, Jean Mayer Professor of Nutrition at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University, Professor of Medicine at Tufts School of Medicine, and an attending physician at Tufts Medical Center. Recently, he also became the founding director of the Tufts Food as Medicine Institute, which is something we'll definitely be talking about on this episode. His work aims to create the science and translation for a food system that is nutritious, equitable, and sustainable. Dr. Mozafarian has authored more than 500 scientific publications on dietary priorities for obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular diseases, and on evidence-based policy approaches and innovations to reduce diet-related diseases and improve health equity in the U.S. and globally. Areas of focus include defining healthy diets, nutritional biomarkers, food as medicine interventions in healthcare, business innovation and entrepreneurship, and food policy. He's one of the top cited researchers in medicine globally. He has served in numerous advisory roles for the US and Canadian governments, the American Heart Association, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations. His work has been featured in an array of media outlets. Thomson Reuters has named him as one of the world's most influential scientific minds in 2023. Dr. Mozafarian was nominated by President Biden to serve on the President's Council of Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. He received his bachelor's in biological sciences from Stanford University, his MD from Columbia University. He did his residency at Stanford and was a fellow in cardiovascular medicine at the University of Washington, where he also received his master's in public health. Finally, he earned a doctorate in public health from Harvard. Before being appointed as dean at Tufts in 2014, Dr. Mozafarian was at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health for a decade and clinically active in cardiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's married, has three kids, and actively trains as a fourth degree black belt in Taekwondo.
And has absolutely no business giving us the time of day. But here we are.
That's a hell of a bio.
Hell of a bio. I did not realize he was a black belt until you just said that.
Yeah. So he could also beat us up.
He could also kick our ass. Yeah. So I think anybody who's listened to this show for any period of time or has followed the Instagram for any period of time is aware of the fact that both Alex and I think that the military nutrition space is a fiasco, just an absolute wasteland, to be intentionally dramatic. But the reason why we wanted to have Dr. Mozafarian on is because, as you just mentioned, and as you will quickly find, if you look up any of his stuff, he is a very well-educated individual when it comes to that same conversation at a larger scale. So at the scale of, you know, the United States. And so we wanted to get an outsider's perspective, an expert's perspective on basically industrialized food and how the United States specifically got to where it is now. When we think of processed food, when we think about the things that are on offer at the grocery store, when we think about a lot of the policies that are put in place, you know, why is the current food environment the way that it is? And that is the type of work that he does. And then more importantly, you mentioned the food is medicine piece, and he speaks about this at great length in today's episode, but just this idea that nutrition does not necessarily need to be conversations around macronutrients and, you know, food pyramids and things like that, but it can actually be a resource that you can use effectively to become a healthier person. So he does disagree with some of the things that some guests, specifically the Sergeant Major of the Army, some guests that we've had on before, but I think he does it eloquently. And I think it's definitely worth maybe a future conversation, but, yeah, like you mentioned, definitely somebody who is supremely overqualified to be coming on here talking about or talking to the two of us, but somebody that we were super, super grateful to have on.
You'll find really two sections in this episode. We start off with the how did we get here, a little bit of history of science kind of stuff, understanding when certain developments in nutrition happened and why, and kind of the things that set the stage, not just science-wise, but also policy-wise and kind of militarily as well, because military history is tied into this for the food system we have in place today. And then we transition to a second part of the episode where we talk more about what is the actual situation we find ourselves in today and what are the potential ways we can get out of it and improve the nutrition environment and the health and wellness of people in the U.S. and globally going forward.
We've talked about this before, and we sort of mentioned in the introduction to last week's episode, just kind of where we want to go this year and some of the stuff that we're looking to create content wise. And I know that nutrition is certainly something that we do want to dive a lot deeper into, and something else that we want to dive a lot deeper into. You like that transition there? Is
nailed it.
It right. Is engagement amongst all of you guys, particularly the service members, but this can apply to coaches as well. And again, I mentioned this last week, but just to give it one more plug, we've built out a resource on the website that you guys can go to. If there are things that you want us to speak about or bring experts on to speak about, but effectively a stuff I want to learn resource. So if you head over to the Mops and Mo's website, click that resources tab, you'll find in the dropdown a page that you can visit to just really submit like a quick blurb, a quick form that we will consolidate. We'll see kind of where the most popular requests are coming from, and that will kind of help us dictate the direction that we take some of the conversations on the show. So enjoy.
Hey guys, before we kick this episode off, just wanted to give a quick plug to the two options that we have for folks interested in training with us. We have the team-based Long and Strong program. And then if you are interested in a more engaging, intensive, more tailored option, we offer one-on-one coaching as well.
And you can find both of those on the training tab of our website, mopsandmows.com. And if it's the team training you're interested, click that link and you will find a 1 week free trial.
So again, if any of the things that we talk about on this podcast are interesting to you as far as training goes, head to the website, like Alex just mentioned, select that training tab and follow the instructions from there. Enjoy the episode.
Well, I guess the starting point for us, because I have I personally have a fascination with kind of the American industrial food system, but I'm curious, based on some of the conversations you've had previously, things you've written, if you could give folks kind of a historical background for how we got to where we're at in terms of this, I mean, processed food, but more broadly, just kind of where we're at as a society when it comes to nutrition.
Well, we're certainly not. Yeah, we're certainly not in a good place. You know, nutrition is killing way too many of us. About 10,000 Americans a week are estimated to die directly from poor nutrition. 21,000 new cases of diabetes. Over 1,000 new cases of cancer every week directly from poor nutrition. So we're really in a bad place. And you know, on the one hand, the food sector writ large, people think about food manufacturers, like the companies that make food, manufactured food products, but there's also the grocery stores, there's also the restaurants, there's also all the farms, of course. So the food sector is all of those things. And on the one hand, the food sector writ large has some really bad tactics today that you know, echo a lot of things that other industries have done, like the tobacco sector, in terms of misleading the consumer and marketing, you know, to children and to lower income and less educated folks, and you know, lobbying intensely and buying out scientists. There's a lot of bad things the food sector does, and so understandably, people are pretty angry at some food sector tactics. All that's true. And the point that I think is really important for us to understand is we didn't get here by accident. And we also didn't get here solely because of a pure market-driven, profit-driven, you know, we want to make money at all costs and we don't care if we make people sick. That's not the only thing that we need to think about. What's really important to understand is we got here because of the two top public health, government, scientific goals of the 20th century, which were to make sure we had enough calories for a booming world population and to make sure we had vitamins in our foods, because of all the science of vitamin deficiency diseases that was born in the beginning of the last century. So we basically created our modern food system to meet 20th century goals. And I can talk a little bit more about those two goals, and the goal about the vitamins and the goal about the calories, because I think it is useful to talk about it. But now we have a 20th century food system that met those 20th century goals. We have enough vitamins, mostly. We have enough calories, but we don't have quality food. And so I think it's important to understand. And again, I hope we can go into some of those historical details. But why it's important to understand is because when I look at how we got there, how we got here, it's a combination of the science of the times, which was pointing to key priorities, government policy, which said, hey, look, we got to take the science and we got to run with it. And then private sector innovation that then implemented the scientific priorities and the government policies. And so when you look today at the rows and rows of monocrop fields across the world that are growing, you know, very, very, very small number of species, strains of rice, wheat, and corn, and doing with pesticides and genetic modification and heavy irrigation and soil loss, and you look at the rows and rows of manufactured, inexpensive, cheap, starchy foods fortified with vitamins, we have to remember that that actually was the conscious goal of science, policy, and private sector innovation for much of the last century. And so today, that's the roadmap to get us out of here, which hopefully we can get to, I think we will get to, is we have to combine the new science and new policy and new private sector innovation to kind of get us out of this mess.
You set it up nicely, and I think we're going to have a little bit more of a conversation about the historical and cultural context behind some of these things, but you focused on policy and innovation and resources, and you've spoken on this before, and I want to highlight a point you've made and contrast it with something we had a conversation about a couple weeks ago. But we had the Sergeant Major of the Army on the podcast, and what he said about the food environment on military installations was that It's not about necessarily like adjusting what food is available and things like that. It's about educating soldiers to help them make better choices, and it's up to them to figure it out. And you've essentially said the opposite on a couple of occasions. It's not about education and awareness raising. Those have their place, but for real long-lasting significant change, you're more of an advocate for actual action on the policy front, passing legislation, putting money towards these things, supporting innovation and things like that. I'd love to hear you lay out the reasons behind arguing for that as the primary strategy at the state federal level.
Yeah, if you look at any of the major successes in public health or human health over the last, you know, couple hundred years, it's not been achieved by telling people what to do or educating people. It's been by changing systems and changing policy. And so if you look at clean water, clean air, a lot of different things, you know, you can see that to be true. I think good examples that make more sense in water and air are products that we use and buy. And so I think of two of those. I think of cars and I think of toys. And so let's look at cars first. So cars are a product we need. We have to have them. They're very helpful, but they're also very dangerous. And car accidents, you know, when I was younger, was one of the top cause, if not the top cause of death for people under age 30. I mean, a lot of people died. And so over the last 90 years or so, cars have become much, much safer to drive, about a 90 or 95% reduction in deaths per mile driven in a car over the last 90 years, an incredible reduction. And so if you say, well, what's changed? Is the driver really that different today than they were like 60 or 70 years ago? Are we educating people to drive much more safely? No, we've changed the car dramatically, which is the product. So, you know, shatterproof glass and airbags and anti-lock brakes and steel cages that don't crush and, you know, all of the safety standards that we have in cars now. We've changed the roads, stop signs and rumble strips and speed limits and all the caution signs, all the different things we do to help people drive more safely. That's the environment. We've changed the culture, you know, especially the culture around drunk driving and what's acceptable and what's thought of as normal behavior. And so by changing kind of culture and changing the product and changing the environment, we've made cars much, much safer. So, you know, if we had just focused on education and just put out every 5 years, right now we put out every 5 years, we put out dietary guidelines, every 5 years we put out driving guidelines, and we put labels on foods, you know, nutrition facts and ingredients listed. We put labels on cars. This car is safer. This car is less safe. That's all we did was education and knowledge and labeling. You know, I don't think we'd have affected car accidents that much. We really had to change the system. And then I think the second example, which I'll just give more briefly, is toys. Imagine today if 80%, 90% of toys were unsafe, and we knew they're unsafe and were hurting kids and killing kids in some cases. And all we did was tell moms that you have to choose and know it's up to you to choose the toys that are safe or not safe. And I suggest you go to the toy store and shop around the edge of the aisles. The worst toys are in the middle of the aisle. Don't, you know, shop around the edges. And yeah, the safer toys are a little bit more expensive. Sorry. You know, so if you're lower income, you got to buy the unsafe toys, and the toy companies are going to heavily market the unsafe toys to you. And you know, that's that. I'm sorry, we can't do that. And some of the stores where you live will only have unsafe toys. You know, like, no, we wouldn't do that. We'd say, let's make the toys safer. So I think it's the same as for food. Like when you have 2-year-olds and 4-year-olds that have type 2 diabetes, when you have half of every adult in our country with diabetes or prediabetes, and 3 in 4 with overweight or obesity, you know, the system is broken. And so, you know, with great respect for the military and for the sergeant of the Army, right, we have to make sure the choices are all healthy. And then let people choose among healthy choices. That's great.
I know we're going to come back to some of the culture and history stuff, but you got me thinking when you mentioned dietary allowances and guidelines and things like that. You're at Tufts now, and there was a huge thing on the internet. It might have been 6 months or a year ago, something like that, around the Tufts food compass and criticism of it and things like that. And I was astonished at some of the commentary around that and how far behind people were on where we were as a country in terms of those guidelines and allowances and things like that. A ton of people, like the headlines were all like, the new food pyramid says you should eat cereals or whatever. And it was just a massive misrepresentation of both the federal guidelines, which the Tufts Food Compass is not that, it's a separate tool, and what it was trying to say. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that whole thing. I'm sure it was something you were aware of just because of how much focus there was on the Tufts Food Compass for like a few weeks there when Joe Rogan talked about it and stuff. But
Yeah, it was a you know, very surreal experience to see. But you know, as you said, you characterize it really well, both to see our work mischaracterized and its relevance to the government guidelines so mischaracterized. And I think it's just, you know, many people have, others have written about this generally in our society today, like in sort of the society of 5 second, 8 second attention spans and clickbait, you know, stories and graphs and figures that feed a narrative that get people angry, catch fire. And so, you know, Food Compass was pretty severely misrepresented. We created a system to as a research paper. We're not proposing that this be, you know, implemented today. As a research paper, we tried to create a system that's better than the systems that are in Europe right now. For example, there's many systems being used in Europe to rate the healthfulness of foods, and we rated over 10,000 foods, and we found that the system works pretty well and works better than the existing systems in Europe. And, you know, there were a few out of 10,000 products, people sort of cherry picked ones that looked funny and sort of made headlines and highlighted those, rather than looking at the big picture of all the foods we scored and what we were trying to say. And we are actually working on updating the Food Compass based on scientific input. And so, you know, even some of the funny cherry picked products actually now score better with our new Food Compass system, which I hope will release in the next few months. But I think the story there was more about, first, you know, how passionate people are about food and nutrition and how people got really angry when they saw things they didn't disagree with. And also how much misinformation is out there, you know, how much misinformation and confusing, conflicting information is out there. If somebody had soberly presented what we found and its strength and limitations, 95% of people would say, yeah, that makes sense. You know, yeah, it's not perfect, but I get it. And I get why you did it. But that would have taken 4 or 5 minutes, you know, not 4 or 5 seconds.
If we've learned anything running this platform, it's that social media does not reward sober analyses of like complex problems. That's just not something that the audience is looking for.
Hot takes.
That's what podcasts are for.
That is literally why this podcast exists, is because we were unable to do a good job of getting longer form messages out via any other platform. That's exactly why it exists. I'll hand it back to Drew here in a second, but for those who are mystified by that whole conversation about the Tufts Food Compass, I did do a brief blog post months back explaining the whole situation.
We posted that.
Yeah, I'll throw a link to that in the show notes. But the short version is Tufts put a lot of effort into creating what's called a universal nutrient profiling system, where you don't have to break foods into categories before you plug them into the algorithm. And then a secondary paper came out talking about the limitations of it, which they're very aware of the limitations of it. But it highlighted how certain foods can score highly compared to foods in other categories in a way that might be misleading for some people. The biggest highlight that pissed everybody off was the way like certain cereals score compared to ground beef or something like that. And it was, it's a valid article. I think it's valid criticism in it, but one chart was taken out of context and it was delivered to the internet in a way that made people think that the government was recommending you eat more frosted mini wheats than ground beef. And it's, sorry, we'll leave that one behind and move on, because that's a whole rabbit hole of nonsense. But
I did want to ask, I mean, you mentioned some of the historical context, and I want to almost circle back around to that and let you sort of take the floor on diving a bit deeper into the calorie conversation and the vitamin conversation to sort of set the stage for where the rest of this will probably go.
Yeah, well, you know, as a cardiologist, a heart doctor who studies nutrition, I'm one of the frequent questions I get is, why is the science changing all the time? You know, it used to be butter was the worst thing on the planet, and then margarine was great, and then margarine was terrible. Go back to butter. Now maybe butter's okay, neutral. What about coffee, chocolate? You know, all these questions. And you know, one answer, of course, is what we just talked about, that social media and other media grab onto things and magnify them and confuse them. But there is also, and lots of people have said that, but I think that the message that I want to give is that there's also the truth that the science has changed and the science is not the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago. And one reason for that is that I think nutrition science is one of the youngest kind of official modern sciences there really are. And to get, you know, to start with vitamins, I would date the birth of really true modern nutrition science is 1932. So just about 90 years ago. I mean, that's not that long ago, within some people's lifetimes that are alive today. In 1932, the very first vitamin was discovered, isolated, and synthesized, which was vitamin C. So it's not like we knew about vitamins in like the 1700s or 1800s. You know, this is brand new science, 1932. And so for the first time in 1932, someone could prove that you could take vitamin C, you could give it to animals or humans, and you could cure scurvy. And if you took it away from animals, it would cause scurvy. And so this disease that had plagued sailors for centuries, and nobody was really sure what caused it, finally in 1932, you could prove that there was a compound, ultimately called a vitamin, that caused scurvy. Now, you know, the British fleet had suspected, due to the work of a sailor named James Lind, that maybe there was something in citrus fruits that protected against scurvy. So they put lime in the grog, which is the watered down rum of the British sailors. They put lime in there to give them a little bit of lime. So that's why British sailors are still today known as
limeys,
right? They called those limeys because if they were taking lime juice, but you know, even though they were taking the lime juice, nobody really knew for sure if it prevented scurvy or what it did. So 1932 was the very first modern connection, although centuries and centuries go back of healers understanding food and health. It was the first modern connection of a compound in food, a chemical in food, and health, a nutrient and a disease. And within 20 years, the science exploded, and all of the major vitamins had been discovered, isolated, and synthesized, and linked in most of those cases to specific deficiency diseases. So vitamin D was discovered. If you didn't get enough vitamin D, you got rickets, which is, you know, bone disease. Vitamin A was discovered. If you didn't have enough vitamin A, you got night blindness, you got vision loss. Thiamine and beriberi, niacin and pellagra, many other conditions. These were really, really common conditions in the 30s and 40s in the United States and around the world. There was a report in New York City in I think it was in Harlem, 80% of African-American kids in Harlem had pellagra in the 1930s. I mean, these were really common diseases. And so that science was really the first time we started thinking about food as delivering something very specific for health, in this case, nutrients, in this case, vitamins. And so all the science of the time said, how do we get enough vitamins to people? And that was magnified by, of course, World War II and the Great Depression. And so this is where the military stepped in. And so President Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew we were going into war before Pearl Harbor. He thought it was very likely. He saw this research on these vitamins, and he saw that, wow, people could be quite sick if they didn't get enough vitamins. So he said, we have to understand what we have to feed the U.S. population to be healthy. And he launched a conference called the National Nutrition Conference on Defense, which was in 1941. And that conference put in place kind of our vitamin policy. It led to standardization of enriched flour. All white flour in the U.S. is now enriched with B vitamins and other things that came out of that conference. More importantly, it led to the RDAs, the recommended daily allowances. Like, you look on the back of the package and it says, you know, X percentage of protein, X percentage of vitamin C, X percentage of whatever of your recommended daily allowance or your RDA. That didn't exist in 1940. That directly came out of the 1941 conference. So that conference and all the efforts that came out of it the next decade or so were focused on vitamins and how do we get enough vitamins to people. Then, you know, the second big thread of science of the 20th century outside vitamins was calories. And that was from a completely different set of problems, which was famine and a growing population. And if we look today at the incredible, you know, human suffering of the war in Ukraine and the disrupted wheat supplies and rising food prices, you know, it's a drop in the bucket what we're experiencing compared to what happened in World War II. In World War II, an estimated 28 million people died of famine, just of famine, let alone all the soldiers. 28 million people died. And of course, that we had a much smaller world population then. So imagine 30 million people dying from famine in the next few years. So that huge, you know, those huge deaths from famine, combined with scientists pointing out that the world population was exploding. We went from about 1.5 billion people in 1900 to 6 billion people in 2000. So more people were born in 100 years than had been born in all of human history combined. And so people in 1950 said, we just went through this incredible famine. The population's exploding. You know, some scientists estimated that hundreds of millions of people were going to starve by 2000, that there was no way the world was going to produce enough food. They just did the math. You look at the acreage we have, look at the food we're producing. And so what that led to was the Green Revolution, which was the Rockefeller Foundation and the government of the United States and the government of Mexico combining together to really figure out how can we greatly increase calorie production. And so a scientist named Norman Borlaug, who ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize for his work, went to Mexico, spent many, many years, and he combined intensive breeding of wheat plants to identify specific wheat plants that could really grow. He combined nitrogen fertilizer from all the leftover bomb factories that had all the ammonia from making the bombs. There was all this nitrogen left over. He said, let's try it as fertilizer. So he created the first artificial fertilizer. And he used DDT as a pesticide because that was also developed in World War II. And he was able to dramatically increase production of wheat. And we're talking, you know, 20-fold more wheat, bushels of wheat produced per acre than ever before. And that was then spread to India and Pakistan, and then similar efforts were spread to rice and corn. And it was incredibly successful. 1 billion people didn't starve by the 2000. We grow more food today than we've ever grown. And we have more than enough food to feed everyone on the planet, which is kind of incredible now that we're, you know, well above 6 billion, we're approaching 9 billion. And so those two threads of science and great successes of the 20th century shouldn't be underestimated. If we didn't discover vitamins and figure them out, and we didn't have this incredible revolution of agricultural production, we would have had, you know, probably 1 billion people die of starvation and hundreds of millions of people or more with vitamin deficiency diseases. But what that did is it led to this modern hyper-processed food product that starts with, you know, industrial production of a handful of crops that are pretty much stripped of most of their nutrients. They're highly processed, turned into cheap, starchy staples that last on the shelf and are, you know, and that are fortified with vitamins. And so, you know, you go down the modern cereal aisle and you see all of these boxes of cheap, starchy calories with vitamins. It was a very conscious creation of the 20th century. So, you know, we shouldn't only be upset at the food sector, the private food sector, because there was a lot of successes. But now today, the problem is we have all these legacy products. We have legacy farms, legacy food manufacturers, legacy supply chains that were built to solve the problems of the last century. And now this is where we need policy change, not just consumer knowledge, but we need policy change to figure out how can we not lose what we've gained. We don't want to go back to the world of, you know, the 1920s, but how do we not lose what we've gained, but create food that's actually nourishing?
We're going to go in a few directions from that one, I think, first, but I want to walk you into the next chapter of that history a little bit. So you've talked about like 1920 to 1950, there's a focus on preventing deficiencies and understanding deficiencies and things like that. The fear of famine, like 1950 to 1980, the nutrition industry successfully addressed these fears, maybe over addressed those fears. We, as things tend to be, the pendulum swung too far in the other direction a little bit. But then we come to, and I might have this date off, you can correct me, you know way more than I do, but kind of the beginning of the discussion of the relationship between diet and chronic disease. And the closest I can chart that is 1980-ish. So where did that come from? And I think it's worth pointing out how recent that was, and we're constantly talking about it today. But that was not very long ago that conversation even began.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolute modern history. It's really not that long ago. All of the threads, as you said perfectly, were from 1932 to 1980. Those 50 years were focused on vitamins and calories. And it wasn't really until the 1970s that scientists and policymakers and the food industry started seriously thinking about diet and chronic disease. And now that we had started to tackle famine and started to tackle vitamin deficiency diseases, we started noticing, hey, you know, people are having heart attacks, and obesity was not a problem yet in 1980, but heart attacks were a big concern. And people were thinking, why are we having heart attacks? And maybe nutrition has something to do with it. And so studies started looking at this question. And there was a Senate Select Committee on Nutrition that had formed right around 1969 in the lead up to the Nixon White House conference on food, nutrition, and health. The Senate Select Committee had formed focusing on hunger in the United States because hunger was really the problem. But after the 1969 conference that President Nixon hosted and really led to a lot of changes in our federal food programs around getting calories to people, after that, those successes, that Senate Select Committee also started thinking about what's going on with chronic diseases, especially heart attacks. And so that Senate Select Committee in 1977 released the first ever kind of government report on what we should be doing in nutrition, not to make sure people have a balanced diet or make sure people are getting enough calories or make sure people have enough vitamins, but to reduce risk of heart attacks. And so that led to the low fat, low saturated fat, low dietary cholesterol focus. And that was codified in the 1980 Dietary Guidelines for Americans that for the first time, you know, recommended low fat, low saturated fat diets. And so what happened, Alex, is the science that worked so well for scurvy and rickets and pellagra, where you find one nutrient that causes the disease and you deal with the nutrient using kind of science and policy and you fix the disease, that works really well for scurvy, where vitamin C is the cause, vitamin C is the cure. But heart disease and cancer and obesity and diabetes and gut health and brain health and mood and memory and depression and all these things that we're dealing with now because of our food system are very complex chronic conditions with very complex physiology. And so there is no single nutrient that causes or cures heart disease. There's no single nutrient that causes or cures cancers or diabetes or obesity. But the scientists in 1980 didn't know that. The policymakers in 1980 didn't know that. They didn't understand that. So they said, look, what did we do that worked so well the last 50 years? Let's take that and apply it to heart disease. And so they said, let's, you know, eliminate fat and saturated fat and dietary cholesterol and we'll eliminate heart disease. And then it took about 20 years, which you could say is a long time or a short time, depending on your view of science. It took about 20, 25 years till about 2005 to figure out that, hey, that was a mistake. And lowering fat, total fat has no effect on heart disease. Lowering saturated fat has complicated effects on heart disease, depending on what the food is and what you're replacing and a whole bunch of other complexity. And lowering dietary cholesterol doesn't have much of an effect on heart disease. We made a mistake. And so it took some time for that to kind of translate into new policy. And so some of those things have been pulled back, which again, most Americans don't realize. So in 2015, the dietary guidelines said Americans no longer need to worry about an upper limit on total fat and no longer need to worry about dietary cholesterol. So two of those three things they actually officially quietly said aren't a big priority, but it was a pretty quiet statement. Not many people noticed. And they didn't remove the limit on saturated fat, which I also think they should have. But so you know, that I think fundamentally we're now in this weird period where we have this old approach of approaching nutrition, old like 1930s to 1980 approach of approaching nutrition, where you find the nutrient and deal with the nutrient. And now this new approach of understanding nutrition, which is, whoa, things are really complicated. We got to think about the food and its processing method and the seed and the farm and the soil and the climate and the gut microbiome and how they're digesting and metabolizing the food and think about a person's genetics and you know, physical activity and age. And it's really complicated. And we're in these two rivers of competing, mixing, swirling evidence. And slowly the second river of this complexity and thinking about foods is, I think, washing away the first river of this kind of reductionist nutritionism science. But we're still right in the middle of that mixing. And that's leading to a lot of conflicting and confusing policy decisions and scientific messages around food.
So one of the narratives that I've come across just kind of researching this and reading into it is that, and you can blow this out of the water by all means, but it's kind of this conversation that the lack of a food culture in the United States, the lack of sort of these historical guardrails when we think of what's healthy, what's not healthy, has left a gap that has allowed wayward government policy or private sector interests to kind of infiltrate the marketplace with nutrition. And what I mean by that, I mean, you hear conversations all the time about like the French paradox and how is it that in France they can eat all these different things, but they don't have these obesity issues. And what's left out of that conversation more often than not is discussion around sort of the cultural norms when it comes to eating, time of day, length of meals, you know, the social constructs around food. We just don't seem to have that in this country. And so we so often look to what's the latest government policy or what is Kellogg's marketing to me today? How does that How does that play into this, and how do you navigate that if you are that, you know, that consumer that only has access to the unsafe toys, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right in that the lack of kind of an established food culture is likely why the U.S. has sort of led in this innovation, right? This innovation around processing and farming and all the things that happened are very much so because we didn't have this 1,000-year, 2,000-year history of how we grew and ate our food. At the same time today, you know, this kind of innovation of modern eating is now has been exported and spread across the world.
So, exactly. The Western diet.
Unfortunately, right, the U.S. has exported this kind of, you know, processed unhealthy food epidemic. And, you know, if you go to Japan today or India today or China today, the prevalence of diabetes among adults is actually about the same as in the United States. And in Japan, it might even be a little bit higher. And if you go to the Middle East, there's many nations in the Middle East with obesity and diabetes much higher than the United States, much worse. So we are not the leader anymore in diet-related illness. But it still remains true, whether it's in the United States or around the world, that people within countries that maintain their traditional diets the most, whatever they happen to be, and still eat more minimally processed whole foods, cook them themselves, and eat them in a way that's, with friends sitting down, you know, mindfully, they do better. They're healthier. They live longer. You know, they do well. So we clearly have to figure out how to gain the benefits of that way of eating without thinking we're going to return to 1920, right? There's never been a big problem in human history that we've solved by going backwards, right? We need to figure out a new solution because we have to also feed 9 billion people. People are busy. We don't have nuclear households with two parents and one parent working and one parent at home to cook all the time. You know, shopping's complicated. Life is complicated. So we have to figure out a way to still leverage what we've learned in making food inexpensive, making food convenient, making food taste good, making it pleasurable, making it full of culture, and making it nourishing. And one of the simplest solutions, Drew, is that we might have to just pay more for food than we mm-hmm. do now, because if we just are racing to the bottom dollar, that's probably not going to work. So that's one solution and problem. And second, we have to leverage big pots of money we already have to pay for that healthier food, because if it's just more expensive, 50% of Americans and 90% of the world might not be able to afford it. So how do we make sure that everybody has access to that true American dream of nourishing, healthy, sustainable food? We have to use big pockets of money to pay for it. And this is where we get to policy, right? Where are the big pockets of money? The big pockets of money are in the federal nutrition programs like SNAP, the food stamps program. A big, big pocket of money is in healthcare. Almost 20% of our economy is healthcare. So I'm a big believer in food as medicine, which is using healthcare to pay for this. We have to use the treasury and tax incentives to push forward the food sector. We've done it for clean energy. We've done it for railroads. We've done it for cars. We've done it for silicon chips. Whenever there's been an industry that's been a national priority for national security, the government stepped up and said, hey, we have to use tax policy to incentivize investment and grow this industry because it helps jobs, it helps America be the leader. What could be more important than growing healthy food, right? So I think we have to go to, this is where policy comes in. There are pockets of innovation going on. There's investors who are interested in the space. Consumers are demanding healthier, more authentic food, but we now need policy to kind of put all this together, weave all this together into a coherent whole, so that I hope the United States can be the 21st century breadbasket for healthy food. That would be amazing, right? If instead of exporting our the worst of our food, we're starting to export really healthy food for not only our citizens, but the world.
Well, and I want to pull on that a little bit more, because I'm curious from where you sit, how that policy conversation happens. And I'm thinking about it specifically through sort of like a monocropping agricultural lens, where, again, as I understand it, a lot of the monocropping sort of system was created initially and has just been perpetuated because of the way that the government subsidizes farmers to grow a singular crop, be it corn, soy, what have you, so much so that it becomes a vicious cycle of it is not profitable for me as a farmer to diversify my crop. However, the more I grow, the broker I get because I have to invest in fertilizers, machinery, et cetera. So it's this never ending cycle of just generating more and more of a singular crop, which then creates excesses of, in this case, corn, which then leads to industrial feedlots because we have to get rid of the corn and it goes to the cows and we have to create all these processed foods. And now 30% of the supermarket is a corn-based product. But it for me kind of always goes back to the policies that are in place to subsidize those farmers. And how do you shift the emphasis from the government to say, hey, instead of just growing this crop, which we've been paying you for so long, what if we diversify and go, you know, who knows, like go organic or whatever? Like, how does that shift actually happen?
Yeah. Well, so I think we definitely, I'm a big believer in using the market to drive change, right? We have to reward people who are business owners and employees of businesses across the spectrum of food to make healthier food. We have to reward them. We can't just say do it and I don't care if you lose money or I don't care if you lose your job, but we have to reward them. The farm, you know, subsidies are definitely one lever. It's about, you know, 20, 25 billion a year that we spend, and we can talk about that. A bigger lever is the SNAP program, the food stamps program. That's 100 billion. So that's four times bigger than the farm subsidies. And as I mentioned before, the biggest lever of all is healthcare. Healthcare is 4.2 trillion. And about a trillion of that is estimated by one analysis from the Rockefeller Foundation, either through healthcare spending or lost productivity to be due to poor nutrition. So we have almost $1 trillion in healthcare that we could leverage, 100 billion in SNAP and 25 billion or so in the farm subsidy. So if I had to prioritize, you can tell where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
I think about the big dollar amounts, but you're totally right that, you know, the 25 billion or so that we spend now, we could spend that more wisely. And that's a really challenging political calculus because you do have large farms, you know, thousands of acres that have been passed down from family to family and have grown crops a certain way. And the farm bill gives them crop insurance. So they know in a bad season, they're not going to go out of business. I mean, farming is a tough, tough business. And if they have a drought or a bad season or pests come in, they'll lose everything, right? Because you have to put in so much capital up front for every harvest. If you lose the harvest, you're out of business. So really what the farm subsidies, mostly what they do today is give crop insurance to kind of guarantee a certain price or return so you don't lose your shirt, literally, if you lose your crop. But we could spend those in much more innovative ways. But how do we do that and bring the farmers along? Because we don't want for them to go out of business. And there are lots of interesting, you know, stories and individual experiences of people who had big monocrop farms and switched to organic farming and switched to rotating crops and switched to growing organic fruits and vegetables and other things. And those farmers say, I'm doing better. I'm making more money. It's amazing. Like my farm's better. The soil's better. I'm making more money. So I know it can happen. But I'm sure there's also stories that you don't hear of farmers who tried that and lost everything. Mm-hmm. So I think this is where the government could step in and try to use that money more effectively. But when you have the big central states in the United States that are probably not well set up to grow fruits and vegetables, but are really well set up to grow corn and wheat, you know, that's a big political problem. How do we start to help those farmers shift their crops? So I think, you know, definitely starting to shift those farm subsidies towards specialty crops and beans and nuts and seeds and fruits and vegetables and helping farmers do that's great. And let's create a market for those products by leveraging SNAP dollars and leveraging healthcare dollars. And that's where I think food is medicine for the last one is exciting. And you know, hopefully we can talk about that too, because this is actively happening now where patients are going to their doctor, getting a prescription for fruit or getting a prescription for vegetable, and their healthcare system is paying for it, which is kind of amazing, but it's happening in bits and pieces here and there. It's not happening across the country.
So we've started transitioning here, I think, organically from the history. Yeah, organic pun, sorry. From the history of how we got here into like what is our current state and what is the way out of that problem. So One of the things that struck me, and I definitely started thinking about this because of previous work you've done, but the National Institutes of Health is made up of 27 different institutes and centers. Cancer, human genome, aging, alcohol abuse, allergy, tons of different projects going on there. But despite all the numbers you just cited a second ago, there is no institute focused on nutrition, and the only institute of the existing ones that even mentions it is the Diabetes Institute. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's this gap in what we're looking at least on the research front when it comes to health and healthcare around nutrition?
Yeah, well, doctors and then researchers that studied health started with the diseases. They started with how do we understand the disease and treat the disease? And so cardiologists started out as people that treated heart attacks, not people that prevented heart attacks. You wouldn't see a cardiologist unless you'd already had your heart attack. But today we've learned that, wait a minute, it makes more sense to prevent the heart attack. And so now cardiologists treat blood pressure and treat cholesterol and treat diabetes and hopefully treat smoking and lifestyle and other things as well. But originally, the whole healthcare system and science system was a treatment system, right? A disease treatment system. So really, we shouldn't call it a healthcare system. We should call it a disease care system, right? Or some people have called it a sick care system. That's the system we have. And the National Institutes of Health, which is the world's gem for scientific research on health, really was also a disease research or sick research system. And so most of the major centers of institutes were on a disease. One about heart disease, one about cancer, and one about diabetes and so on. You know, what we're learning now over the last 10 or 20 years is that many of these diseases share the common soil of poor lifestyle, right? And poor lifestyle shares a common soil of social determinants of health. You know, things like, you know, structural oppression and low incomes and low education and geographic redlining and, you know, all kinds of other problems, which don't just affect Americans of color, right? Go to Appalachia or go to any rural area in the middle of the country. Many people in the army, in the military come from those communities, right? The military is their way out and is their way out. And these incredibly smart, committed people go to the military to get out of those economically depressed areas of our country and do really well. So the military listeners know this better than I do, right? From their own lived experience, how challenging some of the areas of the country are. So we're learning now that foundation of poor lifestyle, particularly poor nutrition at the top, is the leading cause of death and disability in the country. And so we have called for the NIH to add a new center or institute focused on nutrition, like, for example, a National Institute of Nutrition. That would take an act of Congress. And so we really do think Congress should notice this and invest more in nutrition. Until we really start to invest in the science, you know, we're not going to be able to answer these questions, right? We know a lot. We know a lot enough to start taking some action. But so many people ask me, well, tell me more about personalized nutrition, or should I do intermittent fasting, or you know, is protein? How much protein do I need? Or what do we really know about the gut microbiome? What do we know about nutrition and allergies, nutrition and immunity, nutrition and brain health and memory and mood, nutrition and depression? There's so much interesting research about nutrition and postpartum depression, for example. All of that stuff, we're just barely scraping the surface of it. And so we really, if we invested, let's say $1 billion a year in a new National Institute of Nutrition, you know, $1 billion a year is really nothing compared to what we're spending on you know, the negative consequences of poor nutrition. We're spending, as I mentioned, we're spending $100 billion in SNAP. We're spending about $1 trillion in healthcare and lost productivity every year for poor nutrition. And so if we spent $1 billion a year on a new National Institute of Nutrition, I think within 5 or 10 years, we'd start to have some cutting edge discoveries that would really help guide, you know, where we need to go, where farmers need to go, where food companies need to go. And we'll get there eventually because we kind of have to, but the pace we're at right now is really, really slow, and we're not going to get there for 50 or 75 years. But if we had a National Institute of Nutrition, I think we might be able to get there within 10 years and have some real science behind, you know, the policies we want to implement.
So that leads me to a two-part question here. You've used the term food is medicine a few times, and I want to give you an opportunity to explain really what that term means, what it means to the institute you work with, what it means broadly. But I also want to add a second part to the question. And when I hear the phrase food is medicine, I worry a little bit about the implication of medicalizing something as fundamental as food security. And like, especially given that the medical industry is an industry, it is profit motivated, all those kinds of things. Are we sure we want to hand the reins of food policy to a profit motivated industry in that way?
That's a very valid concern, and one that I've had myself and talked to folks about. So yeah, let's delve into food as medicine a little more. So I think the term food as medicine could be used in at least three ways. The first way would be the most fundamental way that Hippocrates used it, which is that food is fundamental to health. And the way that, you know, traditional Chinese medicine and lifestyle medicine practitioners today, or RDNs today, all know that food is foundational to health. The way that Native American, you know, tribes or indigenous people in Alaska, you know, people around the world have known for centuries. That is true. And that is one kind of way to talk about food as medicine. I've also heard people who are thinking of that construct just say food is health or food is life, right? That's kind of the foundational construct. The second way to use food as medicine is to mean that there are, you know, natural chemicals in foods that we could identify and isolate and actually use them as medicine. And that's actually happening. It is really cool and really exciting. I advise a company called Brightseed, for example, in San Francisco, which has now identified, I think, over 2 million new compounds in foods, natural compounds in foods, plant foods that have never been characterized before. And they're mapping them using machine learning and artificial intelligence to biologic pathways of the body. And so these are going to be the things that are in cocoa and green tea and nuts and black pepper and turmeric, right? All these, you know, garlic, these foods that we think have medicinal benefits, but we don't know what the compound is. That's the second kind of concept of finding these nutrients. And I think the third concept, which is the way I use it, is to think about how we can use the healthcare system to actually implement a food-based treatment that treats disease and advances health equity or reduces health disparities. And so that would be like giving a person a prescription for fruits and vegetables, or giving people a prescription for a meal, home-delivered meals that are tailored to their system. So those are, I think, the three ways to think of the term. And again, when I use it, I use the third one, which is about integrating food treatments into healthcare. I do think there's a concern that, a very real concern, that if we use that approach, we are going to, again, go for the profit motive. And so the quality of the food and the ability of the food to treat people and so on will be less than it would be otherwise. At the same time, this is the biggest single segment of our economy, which is the food sector. And so if there is a profit motive to make people healthier through good food, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's better than where we are today. So I don't think food as medicine is the whole solution. I think we also need to think about how we handle food marketing, you know, to kids and to minorities, and how we handle sodium and what FDA's process is for regulating all the thousands of additives that are in food, the artificial sweeteners and emulsifiers and stabilizers. We need to have a program, as I mentioned, to spur business innovators and entrepreneurs through tax breaks if they're doing the right thing. We need a national institute of nutrition. So food as medicine is not the only solution. But I do think, all things considered, if we can start to leverage doctors and registered dietitians and vendors of healthcare and healthcare dollars, instead of paying for $1,000 a month weight loss drugs only, not that we shouldn't do that for the right patient, but, you know, rather than paying $1,000 a month for a weight loss drug, or $300,000 for a cancer chemotherapy, or $100,000 for a bypass surgery, which we already do, you know, let's spend some of those dollars on good nutrition. And so that's kind of the power of food as medicine. And I totally agree with you that we have to, since this is a brand new and exploding area in U.S. healthcare, we have to have our eyes on the ball and make sure that it's not taken over and co-opted by, you know, pure profit motives that don't actually meet the goals.
I'm glad you mentioned the FDA and the advertising piece, because that was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you. I've got a three-year-old daughter, and we go to the grocery store, and at her age now, you almost have to avoid certain aisles, because if she sees any of the mascots or the bright colors or the characters from TV, like, you're going to buy it, or else she's going to throw a fit. And I think back to the tobacco industry and how a lot of their, you know, once we realized how dangerous tobacco was, advertising became not illegal, but certainly a lot more complicated. And I would argue that we're kind of there with obesity and with nutrition related diseases. So why do you think that that same level of policy hasn't been implemented, or are we on the cusp of seeing that type of regulation when it comes to advertising towards specifically younger customers?
So it's a super interesting and complicated area. So I'll just run through a few, you know, kind of pieces of information. So first, other nations have tried ahead of the U.S. to deal with marketing in different ways. And in most cases, there's been sort of a backdoor that industry has found to get around it. So it's very hard to do for food because it's not tobacco, where it's one product and it's kind of clear and obvious. And we want to get rid of it. And so, for example, I can't remember if it was the whole EU or the UK or you know, before Brexit, or which nation it was, but there was a European nation or the EU that banned marketing to kids of food or unhealthy food. And then the country could pass the law, which was politically very challenging, right? They congratulated themselves and then they did an evaluation. And when they did their evaluation, they said, yes, we did it. You know, when they looked at the ads on kids shows, which is where the ban was, you know, all of those unhealthy foods were no longer marketed. But then when they looked at the overall exposure of those kids to those foods on marketing, it had gone up because now food industry was spending on family shows, on shows everybody watches. So let's say a game show or any show, right? They couldn't, so they weren't able to ban all marketing of all food. They just banned it on kids shows. But industry just said, well, okay, we'll spend it on other shows, sporting events or other things. So that didn't seem to work. In the United States, it's particularly problematic because we're the only country with the First Amendment, which is the right to free speech. And again, for your military audience who's you know, fought and died to protect our Constitution, right, that's a pretty incredible right we have. And that right to free speech extends to businesses that are owned by, you know, people who are expressing themselves to market their product. And so, you know, constitutional lawyers have looked at this and said probably the only segment that we could in the U.S. that we could meaningfully deal with marketing restrictions to would be young kids, like kids less than 8 or 6, where there are some, you know, rules I won't get into that maybe you could do something. So I do think it's reasonable to try to limit marketing to young kids under the First Amendment. Food industry does say that they are voluntarily restricting, you know, and are not trying to market to those kids. But I think the marketing in general is just a big, big problem because it's not just marketing to kids, right? When you have sports stars and movie stars and all these people doing these commercials for the worst food, you know, God, every time a sporting event comes on and me and my kids are watching it, I have an 11-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 15-year-old, the food is the worst possible things you could imagine on those commercials. So I think to me, while we could look at FDA or FTC and some laws, I think it's going to be politically challenging. I think we have to figure out a way to make it culturally unacceptable for the powerful people, the influencers in our society to do that, right? You wouldn't see movie stars or you know, singers or other people market tobacco anymore, right? Mostly, right? Because they just know it's wrong. How can we get them to say no? And you know, there are examples like Steph Curry is a great example. Steph Curry, who I sit with on the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition, he said, I'm going to market water. He markets Brita water, right? He believed in that. And there was that great example of Ronaldo. I don't know if you guys saw this about a year ago. He just went on to a press conference and they had a bottle of sitting in front of him as an advert. It was specifically put there because they're, you know, the TV station was being paid to put the Coke there. And he said, no soda. And he took the Coke down and he put up his bottle of water. Coke stock like went down 3% in that day. You know, so I do feel like what we really need to do is make it not culturally cool to market unhealthy food and make it culturally cool to eat and market nourishing food. I think that's where we got to go.
Well, and it's what comes to mind for me, and this is several years back, but I remember in Denmark, they had the sugar tax. They still have some variation of it. And then I think it was just looking recently back, they had, I think in 2011, they introduced a fat tax. And so, you know, food products that were arguably unhealthy, they added a certain tax to that. And then all of that was gone by 2012 because, and the quote that I stole here was that increasing prices for consumers, increasing companies' administrative costs, and putting Danish jobs at risk. That was the counter argument. And so given what you just kind of said there, where is the balance between economic priorities and citizen health? Like, where do you think that we could draw that line between, hey, you know, these companies do have to make money, but it's at the expense of everything else that's leading to, you know, down this road of cardiovascular disease, what have you?
Well, in contrast to food marketing, which, as I said, I think in the U.S. particularly would be complicated and fraught with First Amendment challenges and difficult to implement, and I'm not sure how big of an effect it would have because of all the ways that companies can get around it with product placement and TikTok and influencers and all that. I'm a big fan of taxing unhealthy products. There's no reason that you know, clearly unhealthy products should be cheap. And because they have real societal costs, like we need to have them valued at their true societal costs. That's actually capitalism if we have them valued at their true costs. And so the clear example would be sugar sweetened beverages, right? I think we should have a national sugar sweetened beverage tax. It just makes a lot of sense. There's no reason we shouldn't do it. There's no reason that to consume the product. There's plenty of alternatives. It's bad for you. And let's just do that. After sugar sweetened beverages, it gets a little harder, but there are actually lots of states already that have relatively low level candy taxes and other taxes. So you could tax some other foods. But the way to really get around the argument of you know, higher prices is if all of that revenue then gets turned around to incentivize and subsidize healthier food. So if we take that revenue and we use it to, you know, increase the pay of members of Congress, you know, that wouldn't be very, very attractive to the public. But if we took all that money and we used it to make healthier food less expensive, then you get rid of the arguments around this is regressive or hurting people or food is more expensive. And in specific locations, this has happened. And so Seattle, Washington passed a soda tax, which is still going strong. And they get a lot of revenue from that tax. And they use most of the money from the tax to provide fruits and vegetables to low-income residents of Seattle that couldn't otherwise get fruits and vegetables. And so you know, the people of Seattle say, that makes sense, right? I'll pay 5 cents more for a soda because I know that money is going to a good thing. So I would love to see, and we've written about this actually, have a national system of taxes and subsidies. Now, I don't know when we're going to get there politically, although Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, I think almost every Congress has introduced the SWEET Act. It's called the SWEET Act, which is to tax sugar sweetened beverages. So the bill has been introduced in Congress. It's never really been taken up by any committee or voted on. But, you know, this is where, Drew, I think about dollars again and using SNAP, the food stamps program, and using healthcare. At least that's the subsidy side. It's not the tax side. Mm-hmm. But if healthcare dollars are starting to pay for healthy food, and if the SNAP program is starting to pay for healthy food, then that at least starts to be the subsidy side. But somebody has to pay for that. And so we have to make the case to healthcare. We have to make the case to government and to private payers in healthcare that there's a return on investment for doing so. It is interesting that, like, you know, we could have had this exact same conversation 10 years ago in terms of all the problems, and our conversation would have been the same. But 10 years ago, I couldn't have told you that there's movement on a lot of these things. And there's not movement on marketing restrictions. There's not movement on national taxes, but there is movement on trying to make SNAP more of a nutrition program than it is now. There is movement on healthcare and food as medicine. President Biden hosted in September the second White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health, the last one I mentioned being 1969 with Nixon. And that conference was really electric for the agencies, bringing all the agencies together and telling them that from the president on down, we want you to fix food. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the agencies today. So I do think we're potentially at an inflection point in the food system where if we play our cards right, 10 or 20 years from now, we hopefully won't have the same conversation. Let's do an anniversary checkup.
Deal.
10 years today, let's do another podcast and hopefully the problems won't be the same.
Perfect.
I know we're running out of time with you here. We only have time to ask you a couple more questions. One, I want to ask that the answer could be long. We'll try and keep it short, but I'll quote you. Poor eating is quantifiably the number one cause of poor health in this country and on the planet. It exceeds all other modifiable causes of poor health. So my question is, how do we define poor eating and what is the threshold of poor health?
Well, so for that, you know, for one advance in science has been we've been able to now quantify the impact of specific foods beyond specific nutrients on disease outcomes and quantify those rates of those disease outcomes and come up with these estimates of how much disease is being caused by poor nutrition. And, you know, we do that all the time. For example, tobacco, we could say this many thousand people died of lung cancer because of tobacco and so on. We had that science 20, 30 years ago for tobacco. We didn't have it 20, 30 years ago for nutrition. Now we do. And so in understanding death and disability, we've been able to now understand, based on really about a dozen specific dietary factors that are either consumed too low or too little or too much, what are the rates of diabetes? What are the rates of heart attacks? What are the rates of strokes? What are the rates of cancer? What are the rates of obesity that are driven by those suboptimal intakes of poor nutrition? And so to answer your first question, suboptimal nutrition is defined as, you know, intake below sort of recommended levels of fruits and vegetables and beans and legumes and nuts and seeds and seafood and healthy plant oils and whole grains on the what's eaten too little of. And then on the negative side, too much salt and processed meats and refined grains and added sugars on the negative side. So if you look at those dietary factors, just those dietary factors, and you look at just diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, and cancers, just that, you find that poor diet, you know, is the top cause of those diseases. And if you look at the numbers of deaths from those diseases, that's the top cause of overall cause of poor health in the world. Now, if we actually started to add what we talked about at the beginning, inflammation and poor gut health and mood and memory and all these other things that are probably linked to our unhealthy gut bacteria, I bet it would be even more. So we may even be underestimating the problem.
As we close, I do want to give you the opportunity, because this is now the second time we've had someone on here who's involved in the President's Council. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the role you play on that council, and then whether you think, for better or for worse, that the body or the effect that that body has had on this discussion nationwide?
Yeah, well, I'm very honored that the president, you know, selected me to serve on the Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. The and nutrition was added on by President Obama. And so this used to be just the Council on Sports and Fitness. And so the most famous chair probably was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who went around and was telling kids to do their push-ups. And if you did push-ups and climbed up the rope to the top of the ceiling, you got this presidential fitness certificate in high school. I don't know if people remember that. That was from the President's Council. But in the last 15 years or so, nutrition has been added to the remit of the council. And our job is to both help, you know, promote healthy living to all Americans and to kind of advise the president on what we think could be useful for the government to do. And we've, you know, just started this year. And so we're in the midst of work. We have great co-chairs, including Chef Jose Andres, who's one of the co-chairs, who's doing great work. And what we're trying to do right now is find stakeholders out in the U.S., big organizations, big companies, who will work together with us to really help promote this message, because we can't talk to the American public. You know, we don't have the reach of some of these organizations. And so we hope in the next couple of months you'll hear some new announcements. We've already finalized some of these partnerships, but we've been waiting for the White House to be able to announce them. But we're hoping to soon announce in the next few weeks some really exciting partnerships about getting messages around healthy eating and activity to kids. And so that's part of the public facing thing we want to do is get this message out to Americans. But, you know, I want to just also emphasize what I said at the beginning is we also want to quietly talk to and pressure the White House to do the right thing. And they have a lot of on their plate, Congress and the White House and the agencies, they have a lot on their plate with wars and with silicon chips and battles with China and border disputes and immigration and jobs and inflation. I mean, all those things are very real. And if we don't fix food, this is a national security threat. This is crushing our economy and healthcare costs. This is ruining economic productivity. This is devastating families when a loved one gets sick or dies from diabetes or heart attacks or gets cancer. I mean, who doesn't know someone who's had diabetes or heart attacks or stroke or cancer or dementia, right? So we're trying to get that message also to the government, you know, internally, to really get them to elevate this. And I think that I really want to put a shout out to Mission Readiness, who has been a tremendous advocate for healthier nutrition and physical activity for kids because of the national security implications. You know, today, the great majority of young Americans who otherwise would qualify can't qualify for military service, even if they want to. And while there's a range of reasons, the number one medical disqualifier is being overweight or obese. And so this is truly a national security threat. We're not able to recruit enough people into our military who would otherwise want to serve. So I hope with the President's Council, we can both, you know, get the message out to more Americans that this is a big deal and get the message inside to you know, Congress and the agencies in the White House that this is a big deal.
So there's a ton more we could talk about here. We're going to respect your time and wrap this thing up. I will, as much as I want to take a bunch of time and talk about, you mentioned the President's Fitness Challenge, and anytime the council comes up, people talk about nostalgia around that fitness challenge, but that's a whole episode in itself. So leave that one aside. And I'll just mention that there are a ton of topics that Drew and I had notes on that we would have loved to talk about here. I think we covered the most important ones in this conversation, but I'll throw some things in show notes where they can find other talks that Dr. Mozafarian has given, some good topics we missed out on, a discussion of the whole calories in, calories out thing, how that fits into all of this, what it covers and what's missed when you think about it that way. The idea that obesity is only a minor pathway through which diet affects your health. It's certainly important, but it is only one among many ways that diet ties to health outcomes. He's got some good stuff on dietary priorities, what to focus on, what to avoid, things like that. Those spark some strong opinions. Lots of people have thoughts on those. And then the one I found fun, I don't think we have time for this. We got to close things up here, but he gave a talk at Low Carb Denver. That talk is on YouTube. And I think the comments on the YouTube video are a fantastic example of why it is so hard to have productive conversations around nutrition on social media. They are incredibly toxic.
Is that the name of a conference? Low Carb Denver?
Yeah. Like Low Carb is a national organization, I think. And yeah.
Is there like a High Carb Denver that goes at the same time and fights?
No, this was a conference of heavy paleo, kind of low carb. And I was talking about healthy fats from plant sources. And there were some folks that didn't want to hear about that. Yeah.
Oh, geez. Well, given that Alex is in Colorado, I think Denver is a perfect place to have a conversation with people who like paleo.
Well, I'll just say thank you for your time. This was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for all you do and for bringing this message to folks, and really a pleasure to talk to you. You guys have done your homework and asked great questions, and I hope this podcast is useful, and whenever the time is right, happy to do it again to cover other topics.
Perfect. Thanks. Thank you.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.